The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. We are here this morning to start with case number 09-1661, the State of Ohio versus Maxwell D. White, Jr. For the appellant, Mr. Porter.
May it please the court. My name is Randall Porter. Seated at council table with me today is Nathan Ray. We will be dividing the argument. I will be going first and addressing the statutory construction argument that's before the court, and then Mr. Ray will be addressing the separate constitutional arguments involving ex post facto and retroactivity. The parties and the amici before the court have primarily addressed one issue of whether the trial court, consistent with the Constitution, can, pursuant to 2929.06b, seat a jury that can again consider the death penalty. Prior to answering the constitutionality question, the court must address the issue of whether, in fact, the case fits within 2929.06b, whether that section applies at all. Appellant asserts that this particular case, given the unique factual posture, that it doesn't fit within 2929.06b, and that this court does not and will not need to reach the constitutional argument that's also been briefed before the court. Appellant will focus his argument today exclusively on 2929.06b. The relevant portion of the section is laid out on page 2 of the appellant's brief. More specifically, he'll be focusing entirely on the very first sentence of 2929.06b, which provides, and I'm going to just take a minute to read it because it is the crux of the argument. The first sentence reads, "Whenever any court of this state or any federal court sets aside, nullifies, or vacates a sentence of death imposed upon an offender because of an error that occurred in the sentencing phase of the trial, and if Division A of this section does not apply, the trial court that sentenced the offender shall conduct a new sentencing hearing to resentence the offender." The issue with respect to the statutory construction is that is before the court today is whether the error that the Sixth Circuit found occurred in the sentencing phase of the trial. The Sixth Circuit, as the court's well aware, in Maxwell White, found that the trial judge had erred in voir dire because he had failed to exclude a juror that could not fairly consider the death penalty. The question the court has, then, is whether the Sixth Circuit finding of error in voir dire qualifies for purposes of 2929.06b as an error that occurred in the sentencing phase of the trial. Appellant would suggest that the answer to that is no, it is not error that occurred in the sentencing phase, and would suggest three arguments or three points that support that conclusion. First is the plain reading of the statute, which is occurred in the sentencing phase of the trial. The court's well aware, you've heard numerous countless death penalty cases. You don't get a second jury for purposes of the sentencing phase of a trial in a capital case. You get the same jury. The jury in this case that heard Max White's case was seated in voir dire, wasn't seated in the sentencing phase. Secondly, it's a temporal argument in that occurred in. They're focusing on when the error occurred. The court previously ruled in State versus Jackson, remanded a case in which the court had found an error in the sentencing phase, and I know the court's well aware of this holding, where the court had found that the trial judge had precluded defense counsel from questioning with regard to an issue that affected the sentence. The court sent it back down. The trial judge in that case had to rule of whether the error this court found was an error in the sentencing phase or was an error in the voir dire phase. I think the logic, or know the logic, of Judge Reed in that case is very helpful. Quoting from the fourth page of his opinion, is, the error that the Supreme Court, referring to this court, found occurred during voir dire before any evidence was presented. The error certainly occurred before the sentencing phase of the trial. The logic of Judge Reed applies directly to this case. A second issue supporting the conclusion that this was not sentencing error or error occurring in the sentencing phase of the trial is just looking at this court's previous opinions. And they aren't holdings, and I understand that they are interpretations of 29, 29, 06B, but the court, in a lot of its capital opinions, has chosen, for purposes of addressing the issues, of dividing them into pretrial, trial, and penalty phase issues. We located four cases in which the court had used that division, also in which the defendant had raised a sentencing error with respect to voir dire, a juror sat that could not be fair in the penalty phase. In those four cases, all four of those cases, the court did not address that as sentencing phase error portion of its opinion, but put it as an early portion of its opinion with respect to whether it was pretrial, trial, but the court never labeled that as penalty phase error. The four cases the court did that in is State versus Jackson, which is the one I've already referenced, State versus Trimble, Strait versus Ware, and State versus Frazier. The third and the final point appellant contends supports his position that the error in this case was not error in the sentencing, occurred in the sentencing phase of the capital case, is this: the basic statutory construction phrase, interpretation rule that this court has consistently used is the court has, when reading a statute, has to give effect to every clause in the statute. If the court accepts the state's interpretation, it will literally read out of the statute, will have no effect, the phrase error that occurred in the sentencing phase of the trial.
Mr. Porter, your position is that if we accept your argument here, there's no need to even get into retroactivity of the statute, correct?
That's correct. It will remain for other cases, and but it's, I'm sorry, in the unique facts to this case, it's very limited.
Was your argument presented in this fashion to the Court of Appeals? I know that they are, you know, the opinion here is really couched in constitutional terms, but did your argument get presented in the same way?
It was raised in the trial court. The trial court passed on the issue. It was raised in a footnote in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals chose not to address it. The court obviously has two options. First is the court can determine that it can address the issue and determine that the trial court reached the right conclusion but for a different reason, or understand that the court has the option of saying it would like the benefit of the trial court opinion, Court of Appeals opinion, before addressing the issue. Defense attorneys in capital cases are often criticized for dragging cases out. Sometimes they're accused of waiver. Appellant certainly did not want that in this case, Your Honor.
Mr. Porter, help me with what the Sixth Circuit found to be the error in the case when they sent it back for resentencing.
The Sixth Circuit and the state has cited to a provision of the Sixth Circuit opinion. The court needs to read the sentence just prior to that in the portion cited by the state.
Why don't you help me with that?
It reads, Sixth Circuit, accordingly, We find that the trial judge's failure to excuse Shepard and the Ohio Supreme Court's finding that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in failing to strike Shepard were contrary to or an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent. And again, the key language is the trial judge's failure to excuse. That failure to excuse occurred during the voir dire phrase. What I would suggest to the court is the portion that the state cites in its brief really goes to just the issue of prejudice and not, in fact, where the error occurred.
Mm-hmm. And we translate then, if I'm following your position, we translate the fact that that juror had been seated through the guilt phase and then through the penalty phase as being a sentencing error because that juror participated in a recommendation of penalty. Is that what your argument is?
No, that's the state's argument. Our argument is because the error occurred when he was seated, or she was seated.
Okay.
And she was seated in voir dire.
Yes.
And hence, since the error occurred in voir dire, it wasn't a sentencing phase error.
And you don't think that the juror who was erroneously seated and participated in the imposition of the death penalty is a sentencing error, and because that verdict has to be unanimous, was part of a recommendation to the trial court to impose sentence.
But the error occurred when defense counsel objected in voir dire, and the trial judge overruled the objection, and the juror continued to sit.
So you would be arguing for a temporal view of the phrase occurred in the sentencing phase.
Correct.
In other words, the error has to be during the sentencing phase, whereas the alternative argument would be error affecting the sentencing phase.
And that's exactly the argument, is to contract the way the legislature could have written the statute, which could have written in voir dire error that affected the verdict, trial error that affected the sentencing verdict, or any time the sentencing verdict is set aside on appeal. But that language is not there. It's occurred in, and that's the critical
and
language.
Since we have two ways of reading this, is this a situation where we must read the statute to benefit the defendant?
It is, pursuant to 29-2904. It's when you look at the state's brief, and the amici was submitted in favor of the state's brief, they can't even decide that issue themselves. The state, in its brief, at pages 19 to 20, says this is penalty phase error. The amici submitted from the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office on page 4 of that brief says, well, yeah, this was voir dire error, and it was sentencing error. Well, really, it was both error. And that goes exactly to your point, Your Honor. If it's a question of what it is, then it has to be read in favor of the defense. I just have two more points I'd like to make, and then I'll ask the court, and then I'll sit down and defer.
Counsel, you've only got 3 minutes left. We'd like to hear a little about ex post facto, I think.
Okay. Then I would defer. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Chief Justice O'Connor, member of the Court. My name is Nathan Ray, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant defendant, Maxwell White. In 3 minutes or less, I'm going to talk to the Court about ex post facto and the unconstitutional application of 29-2906 to Mr. White in this case. Without belaboring the factual basis too much, judges, as you're aware, in 1981, the legislature reenacted the Ohio death penalty sentence in Ohio. At that point in time, they had the opportunity to say that upon remand, the death sentence could be reimposed, or you had the opportunity of 20 to life or 30 to life. They chose not to do that. In 1996, Mr. White was convicted. He was sentenced under the then existing statute, which says that upon remand, he could not receive the death penalty. 2005, it was amended to be applied retroactively after this court decided in 2004 Williams. So we're here today with the thought in mind that the legislature has made it retroactive. The state is now attempting to once again reapply the death penalty to Mr. White. My focus has to be, Your Honors, that at the time that Mr. White was sentenced, the original 292906 was in existence and the death penalty could not be imposed. At this point in time, if you're going to go back and you're going to apply it retroactively, it's an enhancement of the sentence that was not there at the time of his original sentence or the original date of his
Well, wait a minute. He was sentenced to the death penalty.
He was.
This was the murder of Trooper Gross.
Correct.
And he was sentenced to death. But why are you saying he couldn't be sentenced to the death penalty? He was sentenced to it.
Under 292906, at the time of the commission of the offense, he could not receive the death penalty upon remand. Because the statute had not been amended at that point in time. The only time it came into effect in 2005.
But you said he couldn't be sentenced to it on remand.
On remand.
He could be sentenced to it at trial, and he was.
He was. But upon remand, the death penalty was not an option. The legislature had not made it an option at that point in time. What they've done is, in 2005, they did make it applicable to everybody back in 1981.
I understand that. And I guess that's just the point. Because if he had the death penalty at the time he was sentenced, and on remand he faces it, he's not getting a more severe penalty than he already had. It's the same penalty if he gets it. I mean, we don't know.
Sure, I understand that. But what the statute has done is they've taken it from a 20 to life and a 30 to life.
Yes.
Where it couldn't have received the death penalty, and they've enhanced it to a position now where before he had the expectation that there was not going to be a death penalty upon remand.
Well, your argument is if he had been on appeal remanded during the period of time, he would not have been able to receive the death penalty if the case had been remanded, but that isn't his circumstance.
Correct.
That would be the circumstance of a different defendant.
Correct. But at the time,
as applied to him, he received the death penalty originally.
Correct.
And at the time of remand, he is subject to the death penalty, and it's not a more severe penalty than he originally received.
But if you look at the statute, and my position is, Your Honor, if you look at the statute in effect, yes, at the time of the commission of the offense,
yes,
upon remand, he could not receive the death penalty. That's the way
Except
the legislature
he wasn't on remand at that point. He was on trial at that
Correct.
Point.
So
and you're saying, so in a hypothetical situation, if his case had been remanded during the period of his trial, he would have not been subject to the death penalty. That's your position, I think.
The position is that at this point in time, in 2005, when the state legislature chose to make, because the first time they did it, they chose not to make it retroactive.
Right.
In 2005, they chose to make it retroactive.
Okay.
That's where the problem comes in.
So your focus is not on when the crime – your focus is on when the crime occurs, not when the remand occurs.
That would
and
be
that's the distinction that you'd like to see us make in the application of either post-2005 law or pre-2005 law.
That's correct, Judge.
Your position would be then that anybody who was sentenced under the original no remand death penalty scheme, no matter when they got reversed, like let's say 25 years later they got reversed, they could not take advantage of the new statute. The original statute would apply and they would not be subject to the death penalty.
Correct. Let me give you an example of why, and I think my time's up, Judge.
You can go ahead.
In 2004, this court decided Williams. The Williams court determined that it could not be applied retroactively because the statute was silent. 2005, it was amended. So everything prior to 2004, according to this court's decision, you could not receive a death sentence upon remand.
And anything after 2005, if the crime was committed and he was tried after 2005, the new statute would apply on remand.
My position, yes, Your Honor. So, and my position is here today that it becomes an unconstitutionally retroactive application of the statute when you're sending it back and saying, okay, now you can receive the death sentence when at the time of the crime you couldn't receive the death sentence.
And your focus on Williams is what now?
It was simply in State versus Williams, as you're aware, Justice O'Connor, that this court determined that because the statute was silent as to retroactivity, that it was not to be applied retroactively.
But the subsequent passage of the legislation that made it retroactive, you don't think supersedes Williams?
That's why we're here today, for this court to make the determination of whether or not it should be applied retroactively, mm-hmm. Your Honor.
But Mr. Ray, when you look at whether the penalty is greater, really what you're talking about is the benefit of the remand rule is not given to the defendant. As Justice O'Donnell was suggesting, the penalty at the time of the commission of the offense and the original sentencing is that your client faced death. What we're talking about here is the idea that if there is a vacation of the conviction, then the individual cannot be resentenced to death. So in a sense, it's a benefit that we're talking about and not an additional penalty, isn't it?
It's an application of the statute that was in effect at the time of the commission of the offense, where he could not receive it. At that point in time, Your Honor, he had his complete defense to the implication of the death sentence on remand. The complete defense was that the statute didn't permit it. 2005, all of a sudden, you have the legislature changing it and saying, okay, now we're going to allow you to do that. And that's our position, Your Honor.
So on remand, he's only eligible for 20 to life or 30 to life?
Along with the other sentences that could be imposed
for
on the other convictions.
Other crimes as well, and not life without parole.
My understanding that this court has determined that life without parole cannot be applied retroactively either.
Okay.
Either. So, yes.
Before you sit down, Mr. Ray, I want to clarify your position. I thought I heard you say that the application should be at the time of the trial, or is it at the time that the crime occurred? What starting point are you using in your position?
I would say that it's the time of the commission of the offense, but in this case.
I thought you said, but I thought I heard you say that it was at the time of the trial.
I apologize if I misspoke.
Okay. It is, in your view, at the time that the crime has occurred.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I apologize for going over, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. My name is Paul Lang. I'm Assistant Prosecuting Attorney for Ashland County, Ohio. I will be appearing on behalf of the State of Ohio today. First, I'm going to address the appellant's retroactivity claim in this case. In the case of Daubert versus Florida, the United States Supreme Court addressed a very similar issue. In the Daubert case, the defendant committed the offense of murder. And at the time he committed the offense, the state of Florida did not have a constitutionally valid procedure in place for the state to seek the death penalty. After the defendant committed the offense, the state of Florida amended its sentencing laws and provided a valid mechanism for the state to seek the death penalty. Ultimately, Daubert was convicted of murder, and he was sentenced to death. Upon review before the United States Supreme Court, the court found that this change in the law was not an ex post facto violation. The court found that despite the fact.
In that case, just so I'm clear, was he originally convicted under the then it became invalid statute, or was there no trial until after the new valid statute came into place?
At the time of the offense, the invalid statute was in effect, but prior to his trial, the legislature amended the statute and provided for a valid mechanism. The United States Supreme Court found that despite the fact, though, that there was not a valid sentencing procedure in place at the time of the offense, this did not constitute an increase in punishment. The United States Supreme Court found that this change to the law was procedural and took particular note of the fact that given the prior law, the defendant was on fair notice at the time he committed the offense that his actions could subject himself to the death penalty. In this case, the appellant was convicted of aggravated murder in 1996. He was sentenced to death. In December of 2005, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals set aside his death sentence and remanded the case to the Ashland County Court of Common Pleas for resentencing. In the Ashland County Court of Common Pleas, the appellant alleged that the application of amended 29-29-06 to him was in violation of the Ohio Constitution's prohibition against retroactive legislation. The trial court ruled in favor of the appellant. When the case went before the Fifth District Court of Appeals, the Fifth District Court of Appeals overruled him. In the appellant's brief in this case, his primary contention is that the change in the law constitutes an increase in punishment. Underlying this claim, as the court just heard, is the appellant's contention that at the time he commits the offense, if the case proceeds in a particular way and a particular event occurs, that event gives him a defense against the death penalty in the future. The United States Supreme Court has reviewed similar claims and found this to be without merit. In the Daubert case itself, at the time Daubert commits the murder offense, if the jury during the sentencing phase recommends life in prison, the trial court has to follow that recommendation. The trial court would be barred from imposing a death sentence. Under the new law, the amended law in Florida that was in effect at the time of the sentencing hearing, took this provision out. In fact, in the Daubert case, the jury did recommend life in prison, and the trial court overruled the jury and sentenced Daubert to death. The United States Supreme Court found that this was not an increase in punishment, despite the fact that this technical defense was being taken away from him. In a similar case, in Collins versus Youngblood, the United States Supreme Court determined what exactly the four categories are concerning the ex post facto provision, one of them obviously being an increase in punishment. More importantly, in Collins versus Youngblood, the United States Supreme Court overruled its decision from Kring versus Missouri. In that case, Kring committed a murder offense. And at the time he committed the murder offense, the law in Missouri provided if he was able to resolve his case by pleading guilty to murder in the second degree, that this would constitute an acquittal on murder in the first degree, and the state would be barred from seeking the death penalty. Kring was able to resolve his case at one point by pleading guilty to murder in the second degree. This plea was accepted by both the court and the prosecutor. Kring, however, appealed the case
No, I was going to just ask when you were completed if you meant that just because a defendant has a potential future benefit, if that's taken away at a later time, that is not increased punishment.
Correct, Your Honor. That is what the United States Supreme Court has found in these two cases. In the Kring case, after pleading guilty to murder in the second degree, he appeals the case because his sentence was harsher than what he claims he had agreed to. The case was remanded. At that time, though, the law was changed. So using the new law, the state then pursued murder in the first degree despite the prior technical acquittal and obtained the death penalty. In the late 1800s, the United States Supreme Court found this to be an ex post facto violation, but in 1990, in Collins versus Youngblood, the Supreme Court overruled that decision and found that despite taking away this technical defense, this was not an increase in punishment. In both Daubert and Kring, we have a technical defense that is clearly available in the initial proceedings before the trial court. And in both of those cases, those technical defenses actually came to light. Despite the fact that they were taken away from those defendants, the United States Supreme Court found that the penalty was not increased. In regards to the appellant's claim to this right about what the procedures would be on resentencing in this case, it's a much more tenuous connection than what was present in Kring and Daubert. In this case, if we're asked in January of 1996 what the sentencing options would be on remand, as appellant counsel refers to it, the honest answer is we don't know in January of 1996. Because there's numerous factors contributing to what the sentencing options would be on remand. First of all, the question becomes, would the defendant in January of 1996 select a jury or a three-judge panel to hear the case? If he had selected a three-judge panel and the case was remanded, the state could seek the death penalty again. Once the appellant's convicted of murder and sentenced to death, if he challenges his conviction, which he did in this court, and in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. If the case is sent back because the conviction was reversed, the state is allowed to seek the death penalty. So there's no clear line in January of 1996 to the present time about the defendant having any vested right and resentencing options at this point in time. The case is similar to the 10th District case in State versus Dykus. In that case, the defendant committed a rape offense. The victim was only 13 years old. At the time of the offense, the statute of limitations was only 6 years long. Prior to that statute of limitations expiring, though, the legislature expanded the statute of limitations from 6 years to 20 years. The defendant in that case was convicted of rape and sentenced. On appeal, he claimed that this modification of the statute of limitations violated the Ohio constitutional ban on retroactive legislation. The 10th District Court found, though, that the defendant did not have any vested right in a statute of limitations that had not run yet. Similarly, in this case, the defendant at the time of the offense did not have any vested right in a resentencing procedure until December of 2005, which was approximately 6 to 8 months after the law had been amended.
Mr. Lang, could you turn to the first argument about whether the statute applies at all regarding the fact that the error should have occurred in the sentencing phase?
Of course, Your Honor. We're here today because in December of 2005, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals set aside the appellant's death sentence. We're here because of what the Sixth Circuit found, not what any other court interprets. I would point the court, as I've done in my brief, to the concluding paragraph of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And it begins with, in order to grant a writ of habeas corpus on this issue, the Sixth Circuit is specifically at this point identifying what the issue is that leads it to set aside the appellant's death sentence. The Sixth Circuit states, in order to grant a writ of habeas corpus on this issue, we must finally consider the error resulting from Juror Shepard's placement on the jury for the penalty phase of the trial.
That is different, though, than the statutory language, correct? I mean, the statutory language says error that occurred in the sentencing phase, which is different from the language you just quoted in the Sixth Circuit opinion.
Your Honor, the statutory language states error occurred in the sentencing phase. That's correct. As far as what the Sixth Circuit is finding, though, is that they're finding an error that occurred in the penalty phase, specifically Juror Shepard's placement on the jury in the penalty phase. Before the Sixth Circuit, the appellant did not simply challenge his sentence. He challenged his underlying conviction as well. The Sixth Circuit reviewed whether or not it was proper for Juror Shepard to sit on the guilt phase. The Sixth Circuit found that these issues could be addressed independently of one another and ultimately determined that it was not error for Juror Shepard to be seated on the guilt phase jury, so the error only comes to light after the appellant is found guilty of aggravated murder. Once the penalty phase begins, then the error becomes present, as the court found.
If I understood Mr. Porter's argument, however, it was that the error occurred in the voir dire portion of the trial when Juror Shepard was seated. And the effect of the error was magnified or came to light in the penalty phase of the trial. But his point is that the error occurred in the voir dire section. Could you address that argument?
The Sixth Circuit of Court of Appeals certainly notes the testimony of Juror Shepard that occurred during the voir dire stage as evidence of her alleged bias towards the death penalty. The state would submit, though, that the Sixth Circuit specifically finds that the error is not her being seated in the jury at all, because it was proper for her to be seated on the guilt phase. The error is when she's remained on the jury in the penalty phase. As far as State versus Jackson that appellant has referred to, in that case, the defendant committed a murder offense. One of the victims was only 3 years old. The error that this court found was that the trial court refused to let anyone notify the veneer that one of the victims was only 3 years old. In that case, it's a procedural issue in voir dire, because for as all we know, every single one of those jurors was biased in favor of the death penalty given the young age of the victim, or they were all proper. We simply do not know in that situation. So Jackson is distinguishable on that point because the error in Jackson is a procedural issue at the voir dire stage of the trial.
Counsel, in this case, under Ohio law at the time of the original trial, jury trial, was it possible to replace a juror after the guilt phase and substitute a new juror in the penalty phase?
That I'm not certain on whether or not the alternate jurors remained in place for the sentence for the penalty phase. As this court found in Penix, it has to be the same jury that considers the guilt phase and the penalty phase. So I'm not clear in this case if the alternate jurors remained after the guilty verdict was decided in this case. Again, though, I would note that we're here today.
Well, the question is, if it was not mechanically possible in the original trial, does that not make a difference?
I don't believe it would, Your Honor, because, again, the Sixth Circuit is finding that the two issues are independent of one another. The Sixth Circuit is finding that it was proper initially for Juror Shepard to be
placed. The issues are independent, but the jurors may not be independent, and that's my question. Does that make a difference?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. Even if mechanically Juror Shepard was not prohibited ever from sitting in the sentencing phase of the jury, the Sixth Circuit is not finding error with anything prior to the appellant being found guilty. They uphold his conviction. So once the sentencing phase begins and this improper juror this allegedly improper juror sits on the sentencing phase, it's at that point in time that the error comes to light. It's that point in time where the error occurs. So we would argue even if the jury was not capable at that time of reaching a verdict because of Juror Shepard, that still it's an error that occurred in the sentencing phase. Because, again, we're here because of the Sixth Circuit, and the Sixth Circuit specifically finds that the error is the placement of Juror Shepard on the penalty phase of the trial.
Mr. Lange, is the phrase ambiguous? I mean, could it be read as either temporal or, as the Sixth Circuit read it, resulting? And if it is, do we not have to view it in favor of the defense?
I don't know that it's ambiguous, Your Honor. I would say that, as Mr. Taylor notes in his brief, issues that arise during voir dire and issues that are during the sentencing phase errors are not necessarily exclusive of one another. In this case, there was apparently an issue with Juror Shepard, and that came to light in voir dire. But again, the issue as far as the error doesn't come to be an impact on this case until after the appellant is found guilty and once the sentencing phase begins. So I don't believe that the two are mutually exclusive, as Mr. Taylor notes. I think that you can have error during both proceedings, but given that the error in this case, as identified by the Sixth Circuit, occurred in the sentencing phase, or in the penalty phase, as they call it, that 2929.06b would apply to this case.
But if you could read the same phrase reasonably in two different ways, isn't that what ambiguity is all about?
I'm not saying that you can read it in two different ways. I'm saying that the error, if part of the error occurred during the sentencing phase, and the Sixth Circuit finds that it does, that in this situation it's not ambiguous. If part of the error did occur in the sentencing phase, therefore 2929.06b should apply to this case.
Counsel, before you sit down, you spent a good deal of time discussing the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the United States Constitution. You haven't discussed Section 28 of Article 2 of the Ohio Constitution, and we have some well-developed case law. The most recent is this year in the Williams case and last year in the Stewart case. Could you address Article 2, Section 28, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason I was addressing United States Supreme Court cases is that the appellant's argument in this case is that his punishment was increased, which is essentially an ex post facto argument. That would make the United States Supreme Court's decisions valid as far as this is concerned. In regards to Article 2, Section 28, Your Honor, you mentioned State versus Williams in this case. Typically, when this court considers whether or not a statute is unconstitutionally retroactive, the court determines whether or not the statute is remedial or substantive. State versus Williams is interesting because this court steps away from the word substantives and makes a decision that the statute in Williams was punitive, which leads to the conclusion that punitive might be the issue that arises when we're talking about retroactivity in the criminal case. Along the whole line of cases, starting with State versus Cook, State versus Ferguson, and ultimately with State versus Williams, in the criminal context, this court continually refers to retroactivity not as substantive, but determines whether or not the statute itself is punitive, which is similar to what the appellants argue in this case, that there's been an increase in punishment. Pursuant to this court's decision in State versus Walls, in which a 15-year-old committed an offense of murder but was not apprehended until he's 29, this court found that there was no retroactivity issue when the legislature took away a potential hearing in which the case should have begun in juvenile court and proceeded after a bindover proceeding to the adult court of common pleas. Because of a change in the law and because of the fact that Walls was 29 years old when he was apprehended, this court permitted that change in the law. This court, along similar lines as what the United States Supreme Court has found in the cases I noted, found that Walls was on fair notice of the potential that he could be prosecuted as an adult, and as part of that decision, this court determined that it was not against Ohio's ban against retroactive legislation. So even if the court determines it on a more liberal guidelines such as substantive versus remedial. I still believe under the court's precedence in this case that given in the criminal context, this court has looked at whether or not the statute is punitive, that the statute in this case does not violate Ohio's constitutional prohibition against retroactive legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Who is Mr. Porter here going to be for rebuttal? You've used all of your time, so you may have 30 seconds.
To the one question, you didn't pick and choose jurors back at the time of trial, didn't pick a new panel for purposes of mitigation. Jurors were death qualified prior to the trial phase. It wasn't a matter of reseating different jurors for purposes of the sentencing phase.
I understand that. The question was whether or not there were alternates that could have been put in place at the penalty phase. It was mechanically or was it allowed, that allowed or not, do you recall?
There was. The purpose of the alternates was, though, if another juror got sick, couldn't continue because of some hardship or something like that. It wasn't because at that point you removed jurors that couldn't fairly consider the death penalty. The purpose that was done during voir dire. Two additional quick points I know. First is I've encouraged you to look at the entire Sixth Circuit opinion. The Sixth Circuit only decided the constitutional issue. It did not decide the 29-29-06B decision. And the final point is, look at State versus Jackson. The state has not contested that the trial court got it wrong. There is no difference in the trial court's ruling in Jackson and the posture of this case. The trial court in Jackson, after you remanded it, found that the voir dire error, this court found, was not a sentencing error but a voir dire error. The state in this case is not contesting that finding. They're trying to distinguish that case. And I'd suggest to you that case is not distinguishable. It's on all fours. It makes no difference whether the trial judge said you can't voir dire on a subject or the trial judge says, I'm sorry, I'm not going to grant your excusal. That's a distinction without a difference. They haven't contested the propriety of the trial court decision in Jackson, which said voir dire error is not sentencing error. Thank you very much.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.